summary.
So if you take the panel through, highlights of your evidence, and then you can answer questions from the panel.
Sure. Thank you. So I've just got a document here that I'll read from. It's just aiming to provide some sort of summary of my evidence. Section 42 report, some of the key matters. So the Section 42A report that I've prepared covers both the strategic direction and urban development chapters of the proposed district plan. These chapters are related but also distinct. I discuss both of these chapters in turn, starting with strategic directions. The strategic direction chapter of the proposed district plan sets the overarching framework for planning in the district. It addresses all the major resource management issues in the district in an integrated manner. The chapter seeks, in particular, to distill what sustainable management, which is at the heart of the purpose of the Resource Management Act, means for the district. In particular, it seeks to provide the strategic framework for providing for the social, economic, and cultural well-being of people and the community, whilst achieving the environmental objectives espoused in subsections A, B, and C of Section 5.2 of the RMA. In terms of the social, economic, and cultural well-being of the district and community, some key issues have underpinned the approach of the proposed district plan and the framework provided by the strategic direction chapter. So I'll just take you through some of those key issues. Step by step. The district is one of the fastest growing in the country, and this is projected to continue into the mid to long term. This growth creates significant opportunities, but also challenges. The district's infrastructure is coming under increasing pressure from development, in particular the roading infrastructure. Strong population growth and an insufficient housing response has contributed to significant increases in house prices and rents. These trends have the potential to significantly undermine social and economic well-being, and even health and safety, as overcrowding in housing is becoming more prevalent. The outstanding landscapes of the district have both strong intrinsic and economic value. Inappropriate or unmitigated development may detract from both the intrinsic and economic value of these landscapes. Farming is an important part of the economy, and it needs the ability to evolve and respond to changing economic conditions. Much of the landscape character of the district derives from historic and current agricultural land use. Increasing prevalence of housing developed in greenfield locations well away from centres and at low densities, does not readily support public transport, cycling or walking, and is inherently reliant on private transport. This places greater pressure on road infrastructure. These issues are exacerbated in this district as there are limited options in terms of routes into the main urban centres, and the low permanent population base makes it difficult to support public transport far-flung residential locations. Continuing to respond to an expansive, low-density development pattern will be costly to the community, more costly than the proposed pattern that seeks to intensify development in strategic locations, whilst still providing, it must be added, significant potential for greenfield development. Whilst a strict hierarchical approach to managing commercial centres in the district is not considered necessary, as you've heard from Dr. Philip McDermott, a framework is still required to help optimise the form, function and role of the major centres. Following on from Mr. Colgrave's evidence, I thought it would be useful for the panel if I briefly discuss the important matter of population growth and dwelling capacity. These factors get to the heart of the planning approach taken in the proposed district plan. You heard from Mr. Colgrave about population projections. Mr. Colgrave has projected average annual population growth in the district of 3.4% up until 2031, which takes the estimated population of the district from approximately 32,000 to 55,000. The dwelling capacity model estimates that under the operative district plan, there is capacity for around 15,000 dwellings in the district's urban areas. If North Lake and Wanaka, recently approved by the Environment Court, is added, that figure becomes something like 16,500 dwellings. In addition to this capacity, there is significant latent capacity in rural areas and obviously potential for a significant amount of extra rural residential housing subject to a discretionary planning process. Whilst we do not have precise figures and further work should be done, a preliminary estimate is the additional residential and mixed-use zoning proposed in the proposed district plan will take the urban dwelling capacity to around 20 to 22,000 dwellings, so an increase of some 5 or 6,000. If one assumes an average household occupancy of 2.5, that is provisioned for between 50 to 55,000 additional people. This provides significant contingency relative to the population projections for 25,000 extra people in the district by 2031. Significant contingency is required, not only because not all the capacity will be delivered on, but because of the reality in this district that dwellings are often second homes or used as Airbnb-type visitor accommodation. It should be emphasised that this is not a precise science. Recent experiences in Auckland shows that there can be significantly divergent opinion between experts. However, I am satisfied that the work we have undertaken provides reasonable confidence that there is more than sufficient dwelling capacity to cater for the next 15 to 20 years of growth. And this provides me with confidence on the use of urban growth boundaries. Moving to the environmental objectives espoused in Section 5, 2, A, B and C and Section 6 and 7 of the Resource Management Act, some of the key issues include the aforementioned landscapes of the district, Indigenous biodiversity and the threat posed to the environment and landscape by wild species. The detailed provisions for the latter two issues are to be considered in more detail in the rural chapters to come in the next hearing stream, whilst the landscape issues are considered in detail in the hearing in this stream on landscape. Rounding out part two of the Resource Management Act, in addition to these social, economic and environmental matters, it is critical to acknowledge Section 8 of the Act in terms of the Treaty of Waitangi, as well as the principle of kaitiakitanga in Section 7A. I consider that the Strategic Direction Chapter provides a framework to address all of these Part 2 matters. I now turn to the structure of the Strategic Directions Chapter. In terms of plan structure, the Strategic Direction Chapter sits at the top of both the Strategic section of the proposed district plan in Part 2 and at the top of the plan as a whole. It is structured around seven goals under which sit objectives and policies. The goals can be seen as anticipated environmental results, or perhaps higher order objectives, but also function in a structural way as a policy category heading. The chapter seeks to be succinct, avoid long-winded preamble and explanation, be accessible, and unambiguous. It aims to assist planning administrators and decision makers in the assessment of resource consent applications, plan changes and designations. I think it is also important to point out too that a key intent with this plan and its structure is for it to be a lot more accessible to lay people than the operative district plan. In response to submissions and further submissions, I have recommended a number of changes. These range from relatively minor wording changes to significant changes, such as the addition of new objectives and policies and the deletion of objectives and policies. I'll just take you through some of the highlights of the main changes that I've recommended. Firstly, providing recognition of the important commercial role that wider Frankton fulfills, in addition to the Queenstown and Wanaka town centres, and enabling its integrated development. Several submissions raise this matter, with some focusing on Remarkables Park rather than the broader Frankton area. However, I consider it important to consider Frankton as a whole, rather than its disparate parts, and the importance of recognising and providing for integrated development of the area. Secondly, providing more explicit recognition of the tourism industry and seeking to enable its growth, balanced with environmental considerations. Of course, tourism is critical to the district's economy, and given this, deserves explicit recognition. Doing this, I consider, does not come at the expense of the environment, as other objectives and policies in this and other chapters provides for counterbalancing consideration of such matters. Thirdly, providing greater recognition of the important role of infrastructure for the district, balanced with the need to protect landscapes and the environment. A number of submitters requested greater recognition. I have recommended changes that are relatively generic in terms of infrastructure, avoiding specific emphasis on particular forms of infrastructure. Doing the latter would draw out the chapter and potentially start to challenge the goal of succinctness and generality, and I consider it more appropriate to emphasise and recognise the particular forms of infrastructure and their specific needs or issues in the lower order chapters. Fourthly, deletion of a number of policies under Goal 2, as these are considered to unnecessarily replicate objectives and policies in the Urban Development Chapter. Whilst I disagree with some submitters who argue that replication or mirroring of policy or policy themes between the Strategic Direction Chapter and lower order chapters is inherently problematic, I consider that in the case of the policies under Goal 2, replication of these with a policy in the Urban Development Chapter was unnecessary. Fifthly, amend policy so that the policy approach is less absolute in prohibiting the planting of wildland species. The recommended change policy still takes a strong stand, but provides a degree of flexibility that was lacking in the proposed plan as notified. And finally, in terms of my summary of my recommended changes, amend wording under Goal 5 and delete policies that relate to mapping landscapes or urban growth boundaries. These are specific methods which I consider are better espoused in lower order chapters. I think the focus on the strategic chapter is on high level resource management outcomes rather than the methods to be implemented to achieve those outcomes. I now turn to Chapter 4, the Urban Development Chapter, which is intrinsically linked to the Strategic Direction Chapter, and in particular Goal 2 of Strategic Direction. The Urban Development Chapter sits under the Strategic Direction Chapter in Part 2 of the proposed District Plan, and develops in greater detail the urban growth management approach sought through Goal 2 of the Strategic Direction Chapter. This chapter was considered necessary given the significant urban growth pressures the district faces. Urban development or growth stands alone as a highly significant issue for the district. The chapter is structured around six objectives, with policies under each of the objectives. The first three objectives and associated policies set out broad principles of urban growth management, whilst the final three objectives and associated policies apply location-specific provisions for Queenstown, Arrowtown and Wanaka. Fundamental to the planning approach espoused in the chapter is the application of urban growth boundaries, promotion of high density zones and strategic locations, and an integrated approach to urban development. This approach is considered to best realise the purpose and principles of the Resource Management Act for the district. In addition, I consider it the best option to satisfy Section 31(1)(a) of the Resource Management Act. Achieving integrated management of the effects of the use, development or protection of land and associated natural and physical resources of the district. In my view, it is also a planning approach consistent with the framework set by the proposed regional policy statement. Objective 3.8 of the proposed regional policy statement states, urban growth is well designed and integrates effectively with adjoining urban and rural environments. Policy 3.8.1 under that objective states, under managing for urban growth, promoting the management of urban growth in a strategic and coordinated way, and a particular focus on managing urban growth so that infrastructure is provided in an efficient and effective and planned way and avoids additional costs that arise from unplanned ad hoc infrastructure expansion. The evidence of Mr. Glasner supports the efficiency, cost and certainty benefits realised from an urban growth management approach as advocated by the Council in the proposed plan. I think it is also particularly important to note that the approach of applying urban growth boundaries is not a novel concept at all for the district. Multiple community processes over the past 10 years and subsequent plans and strategies, such as Wanaka 2020, the Growth Management Strategy 2007, and the Urban Design Strategy 2009, espouse the approach of urban consolidation and the application of urban growth boundaries. I consider that the mapping of urban growth boundaries in the proposed district plan is the ultimate realisation of that history of consultation and policy development. I also note that when I was district plan manager of the council, a significant part of my role was working on the Queenstown Housing Accord and special housing areas. Of particular relevance is the feedback that was received during consultation on these processes. Overall, a very strong view was expressed that more urban development in the countryside is undesirable. I have noted Mr. Glasner's view that from an infrastructure planning and funding perspective, that he supports a growth management approach where urban growth boundaries are applied. Mr. Clinton Bird also supports the approach, noting especially the importance of the district's landscape and his view that the council's approach can help protect that landscape. The Section 32 report prepared in support of this proposed approach considered alternatives to the proposed approach of applying urban growth boundaries. Two alternative options were considered, essentially the status quo, where urban growth management principles are espoused, but only the urban growth boundary in Arrowtown is retained, and an option of removing growth boundaries altogether. It is acknowledged that, like many, if not all, regulatory approaches, the application of urban growth boundaries will generate costs. Given the widespread utilisation of growth boundaries both nationally and internationally, there is a deep history and evidence base for their use and their costs and benefits. Council relied on this deep history of evidence and research in assessing their application for the district, and also gave consideration to district-specific factors. In my view, there is not an argument that urban growth boundaries should necessarily be applied universally. I think there are some districts in New Zealand, including growth districts, where there may be a less compelling case for urban growth boundaries. However, there are, in my opinion, a number of compelling reasons for the application of growth boundaries in this district. Primarily, as I outlined previously, these relate to protecting the district's outstanding landscapes, as well as rural areas with particular amenity value. I do not accept the view of some submitters that sufficient protection is provided to landscapes and rural amenity values in the district without the application of growth boundaries. I accept that protection is certainly offered. However, I consider that the application of growth boundaries complements or builds on the protection provided by other regulatory methods. In addition, the use of growth boundaries does not solely relate to a function of protecting landscapes and rural amenity values. Very importantly, as I've already stated, it relates to efficient use of the land resource, integrated management, infrastructure planning, delivery and costs. Now, these matters are not necessarily addressed by objectives and policies pertaining to the rural areas themselves. One of the major concerns with the application of growth boundaries in terms of costs is adverse impact on land value and housing affordability. However, given the large capacity of greenfield land contained within the proposed growth boundaries in the district, together with the proposed utilisation of low-impact or gentle infill housing in the low-density residential zone, the proposed medium-density zone, the more enabling high-density zone, and the proposed business mixed-use zone, I consider such concerns as sufficiently mitigated. In addition, I note that increasingly within planning practice, the overall holistic costs of housing are considered. To be more specific, cheaper housing located remote from employment centres may not be as affordable as it appears when, for example, transport costs are factored in. In addition, such a simplistic view of housing affordability does not necessarily factor in the cost to the community or the environment of far-flung low-density residential development. I think it is also critical to underline that provisions in the proposed district plan acknowledge the need to monitor land supply and development and provide the flexibility for the position of urban growth boundaries to be reassessed in the future. There is not, nor was there intended to be, an unbending, inflexible commitment through the proposed district plan to necessarily lock the urban growth boundaries down in perpetuity. On this point, I note that Council will continue to monitor zoned land supply and uptake of development through its dwelling capacity model. In addition, I thought it would be useful to mention I'm on the Government's Working Group on a National Policy Statement on Urban Development. And this National Policy Statement is also highly likely to compel councils to stay on top of monitoring housing supply and demand and recalibrate plans to respond if required. Such recalibration could, of course, include adjustment of urban growth boundaries. Overall, I continue to support the proposed urban growth management approach. I think there are sufficient safeguards to ensure the cost of its approach are manageable, and I see this proposed approach as central to the whole proposed district plan in giving effect to sustainable management in the district. I have therefore not recommended significant changes to the urban development chapter. The changes I have recommended largely relate to some phrasing amendments to assist with clarity and respond to some good points raised in submissions. Thank you.
Mr. Robinson.
The first question I wanted to ask you was about the structuring of the strategic chapters. We've got multiple layers here, as you say. We've got higher order objectives, aka goals. We've got still high objectives in the strategic section. You've got slightly lower order urban growth objectives in Chapter 4. You've got landscape provisions, which might apply in urban areas. You've got zone statements, and you can undertake the same analysis in the rural areas. Having reflected on all of these layers and having deleted some policies because of the duplication, do you think all of the divisions in this part that we're looking at are still required? Could they be collapsed to get something simpler, tighter, more understandable?
Collapsing them is certainly one option, but I stand by the current structure. As I stated earlier, the aim of the strategic direction chapter was for it to be high level but also meaningful. I think that's very important. We didn't want it to be so high level in general that it lacked impact or meaning. I stand by the strategic direction chapter sitting as its own chapter. I would also stand by having a landscape chapter and an urban development chapter, because I believe landscape is a critical issue for the district, and deserves its own chapter. Similarly, urban development, I think, deserves its own chapter. And you know, I guess the danger of collapsing everything into one chapter, I guess, is you perhaps start to dilute the purpose or the integrity of those separate chapters in the direction that they're intending to give. But to come back to your original question, I mean, it's certainly a possibility. There's nothing to say that that couldn't be a valid option. But at present, I'm standing by the approach we've taken. So.
Well, picking up on that, I think your summary, in fact, emphasises it. In terms of the big picture strategic provisions, avoid the distinction between objectives and policies, aren't the urban growth boundaries right at the forefront? Similarly, mapping O&Ls and O&Fs. So if we're going to say, well, what's high level really important, wouldn't they be higher on your list?
Yes, they are high on the list, and that's why we had policies relating to the application of those approaches in the chapter originally. However, I reflected on the submissions that were made, and I thought there were valid submissions and criticisms of the approach, especially in terms of replication. And I consider that some drawing back of the strategic direction chapter was appropriate. So, for example, in terms of current policy that's promoting the use or the application of urban growth boundaries, we've still retained the original objective, which is what we're trying to achieve. So that's not lost. I think it's the urban development chapter which, for me, then delivers the more finer-grained approach of how you deliver on that high-level objective, which is in the strategic direction chapter.
All right, just take the urban growth boundaries as an example. I can understand the rationale for each urban growth boundary being in a slightly lower level, but the principle of setting urban growth boundaries as your main mechanism for constraining urban growth, isn't that a strategic position?
Yes, I mean, I think it's still a valid case for having a policy in the strategic direction chapter in relation to the application of urban growth boundaries.
Now, in terms of the focus on identifying the role of the different town centres, the suggested new provisions in Chapter 3 related to Frankton. I've got a mixed bag of questions, mostly emerging from the discussion I had with Dr. McDermott. First of all, you in policies, the objectives and policies, the ones in 3211 and the policies related to it are referring to Queenstown Wanaka town centres with a small t and a small c. And it seemed, I think Dr. McDermott made it clear that at least as regards the Queenstown one, he was operating on the basis of a different definition of town centre, the role thereof, to what zoned town centre. So how do you suggest we handle that mismatch?
First, I don't necessarily think it's a mismatch. I think Dr. McDermott has done certain economic analysis on the basement of, I think, census area unit catchments. So he was, in terms of his analysis, for example, on Queenstown, he was looking at something wider than the Queenstown town centre. However, the intent of these provisions is really to be focusing on the town centres themselves rather than some of the peripheral areas beyond the town centres. So, for example, in Queenstown, on Gorge Road, there's a stretch of business zone land or proposed business mixed use zone in the proposed district plan. Now, Mr. McDermott would have factored that into his economic analysis, but What we're trying to focus on here is actually the town centres themselves, rather than some of the secondary extensions of the town centre proper. So I don't necessarily think that there's a mismatch. Mr. McDermott has just done his analysis on the basis of certain catchments. So having said that, I accept that you could potentially refer to something wider than the town centres themselves. But as I say, the primary focus was on the town centres in a strategic sense.
Is it axiomatic that the use of the word town centres with small t and small c and these objectives and policies is equal to the land zone town centre, which has a capital T and a capital C, elsewhere in the plan?
I think the intent behind the provisions was that it was the same as the town centre, zone town centres in the proposed district plan. And that's why, as I said before, in terms of our thinking here, it was not including, for example, the land on Gorge Road.
Should perhaps then maybe by way of footnote that be clarified? So, because otherwise there is that general use of the term may be different from the explicit. If the explicit is intended, perhaps we should have that clear.
Yes, I support that approach.
And presumably you'd agree that there's a certain irony about emphasising civic nature, civic facilities, the town centre, either with a large or small C, the T and C, provides when QLDC's principal offices are not within that area. Is there a fundamental sort of?
Sorry, could you clarify? Council's offices aren't
in Gorge Road.
Yeah, that's right. They're in the town centre, so that's why we're focused on the town centre. And
well, I think that you've agreed there's some room for clarity, but in Frampton, the focus is not so much on the town centre, however devised, as the commercial areas. And Dr. McDermott, after we were circled round a lot, made it clear that his economic analysis, when he talks about mixed use, he's referring to commercial and industrial areas. These provisions all focus on the commercial area. Does there need to be a separate, either combined with the industrial areas or a separate set of strategic objectives about the industrial mixed use function of Frankton?
And could I add to that, what's your view of what is meant in here by mixed use? We asked Dr. McDermott that and he gave us an answer, but what's your take on that in regard to how you've set it out in this chapter?
Sure. So if I could answer or reply to the first question first. I mean, again, I think there's certainly some validity in having additional policies or an additional subsection that deals with more of the industrial land issues. We've obviously touched on those, but it's perhaps something that is perhaps a little bit light in the chapter, in this section. In terms of the second question around mixed use, I did talk to Mr. McDermott after he presented, and essentially our discussion was along the lines of there is actually a lot of residential development capacity through Frankton Flats and Remarkables Park. There's capacity for thousands of residential dwellings, apartments, townhouses. So I do consider that when looking at Frankton as a whole, it is very much a mixed-use environment. Mixed use in terms of high-density residential development, retail, of course, services, light industrial. So whether you can define mixed use better in these policies, perhaps you can, but I would stand by the use of the phrase mixed use for Frankton, because I do truly believe it is a mixed use environment when you view it as a whole, but also within the subparts too.
My question to Dr. McDermott, or one of my questions, was around how to distinguish the different roles of Queenstown and Frankton, given that mixed use, as I think I might have put it, covers a multitude of sins. Like, obviously, it's an accurate description, but it doesn't create any sense of why that's a complementary development to Queenstown. So how do you suggest that might be made clearer?
Well, I guess to some extent we've tried to distinguish between the centres with the recommended changes to policy 32111 around the civic and cultural functions of Queenstown and Wanaka. Of course, Frankton does have some of those functions, but I would suggest that it's the Queenstown Wanaka centres, especially at present, where that use is dominant and where there's historic sort of precedence for that use. In terms of greater distinction between the centres and their roles, you're right, I mean, both centres have a diversity of uses. To me, Frankton and Remarkables Park has always been more about servicing the local needs, and I think the town centre has been a lot more focused on servicing tourism needs, hospitality, the whole cultural side of things as well. But again, I guess, Remarkables Park has a lot of capacity to develop, so it may develop more of those functions into the future. So it's a challenging question. I see where you're coming from. For me, perhaps the most important thing, though, is to recognise the importance and the prominence of those three centres and trying to set a policy framework that helps prevent the fundamental dilution or weakening of those centres. To me, that's probably more important than defining what their differences are. But obviously, the differences have been important to Mr. McDermott's analysis, because he sees them as complementary rather than threatening each other. So.
And I think in your summary you referred to all of Frankton. Does that suggest that you would reflect on the policy that seems that Frankton comprises, the objective, comprises Remarkables Park, Queenstown Airport and Five Mile?
Yes, that obviously came up the other day. I agree that comprising those three entities makes it seem that it's only those entities, and I think the idea was tabled that that should be widened so the wording could be including those and possibly more. I think it was Commissioner Gilmore who mentioned Frankton Corner, for example.
And also the industrial zones, because taking your mixtures.
That's right. So, I mean, I think the wording comprising could be kept, but we could have a couple of additions to that list. Or it could be reworded as including those three entities as perhaps the dominant entities within that wider mix.
Can I ask you a point of clarification, which goes to the intent of these policies? You suggested 32123, avoid additional commercial rezoning. Is that in the Frankton Flats area or anywhere in the district?
That was intended to be anywhere in the district. I guess most particularly Queenstown. But it was also intended to relate to the Frankton area. So, for example, if an individual came into council for a private plan change application for a new commercial zoning in Frankton, it was intended to apply to that circumstance, where that could potentially erode the viability or function of these existing centres within the wider Frankton area. So.
And in the, going back to Queenstown, in the comparable policy, 32113, promote vote, growth in the visitor industry, encourage investment, quality of attraction facilities and services within the Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centre. The one that I had in mind particularly was visitor accommodation, where there wouldn't seem to be a lot of room for any expansion in the Queenstown Town Centre, and as zoned, most of the large visitor accommodation centres are in fact outside the town centre as defined. Is there room to be clearer about what you mean? Because talking about attractions, facilities and services seems to cover the entire gamut of tourism attractions.
That's a fair point. I think the intention behind that policy, which may not have been realised as well as it could have been, was basically to set the scene for the lower order chapters, the town centre chapters, where we've taken generally a more liberal approach to development controls and other regulation, so that can try and allow the town centres to fulfil their potential to deliver on those needs of the tourism industry and so forth. So there is a connection between that policy and the lower order chapter. But I agree that the wording could be improved so it is just clearer as to what that's trying to say.
Is it also the intention of that policy that it cover areas adjoining the town centres? It's not clear at the moment, but in both Queenstown and Wanaka, the visitor accommodation tends to be beyond the town centre zone itself, which you've said the town centre should apply to. I'm just wondering if that policy needs to be phrased to make it clear that it goes beyond that immediate vicinity.
The primary focus of these provisions are the town centres themselves, but I accept your point, and you're right. And in fact, in the high-density residential zone, one of the key reasons that was sought to lift height limits is to enable the potential for more hotel developments to occur close to the town centre, recognising that factor. So it's a good point.
Presumably that policy is aimed, originally was aimed at that outcome within the high-density
yes.
residential.
So again, the wording could potentially be changed to clarify that it's also applying to those surrounds, because there's a fundamental relationship between those surrounds and the town centre itself.
Can I pose a question to you few words in your 3216 that seem to have been something of a lightning rod for dissatisfaction among a number of submitters referring to the strong productive value of farming. Having reflected on the fuselage of criticism, mostly from the tourism sector, would you reconsider how that is framed? You may already be considering it as part of your wider.
No, I stand by the wording as it is, and that's why I didn't recommend changes, because the objective says recognise the potential for rural areas to diversify their land use beyond strong productive value of farming. I mean, historically, farming has been central to the rural areas in the district, and is still important. And the objective actually contemplates that there'll be a diversification further diversification of land uses beyond farming. So part of the intent for that objective was actually to help enable tourism activities. It certainly recognises farming quite strongly, but it's going beyond that and trying to provide a bit of diversification. And one of my recommended changes to provide greater emphasis on enabling tourism, and so I think that's a further factor that counterbalances that. So.
Thank you for that. Can I go to the discussion you have in your report and to the suggested amended provisions related to infrastructure? You've recommended a policy for safeguarding efficient and effective control of regionally significant infrastructure. The first question is, given that the objective is focusing on the district's infrastructure, what's the rationale for narrowing it to regionally significant infrastructure in the policy?
I don't think there was any intent behind having different language there. The wording of the objective could be amended to the district's regionally significant infrastructure. However, one could argue that the objective at the moment is wider than just regionally significant infrastructure. Includes other infrastructure which is still of some importance. But I think in terms of this being a strategic chapter and its high level focus, it should perhaps be on the regionally significant infrastructure, in which case the amendment to the objective could be possible.
And in terms of your suggested definition of regionally significant infrastructure, clearly that leans on the proposed RPS but doesn't entirely adopt it. The question I have for you is that as regards the telecommunication networks and indeed the electricity distribution networks, the way the definition is framed appears to me at least, go down to individual house connections. Is that really regionally significant? Should some line be drawn in the definition to get a greater sense of that strategic importance?
I haven't had the time to properly reflect on what the further revision could be, but that seems a logical point. I think it's just worth emphasising that we did draw heavily on the proposed regional policy statement and look to amend that to account for the district's unique characteristics.
Well, can I suggest to you that if the telecommunication and electricity distribution networks go down to house connections, you immediately bring into the frame your potable water and wastewater networks, which are at least as important to householders?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I need to reflect further on what an amended definition might be. That's a good point.
And I think we addressed this with legal counsel on the first day as well, just in terms of telecommunication and radio communication facilities, what's the difference between a facility and a network? And as Mr. Winchester pointed out, there's problems with the Greater Wellington RPS in terms of how that relates to that and what I think some of the telcos in particular think is a facility and what isn't.
Sure.
So just because it comes down to, as Commissioner Robinson said, if it's right down to individual individual house connections, then how does that flow through to the remaining chapters and the potential implications of that?
Fair points. I think it's something which we need to review and reconsider.
And while we're talking about that definition, you have, as you said, you leaned heavily on the regional policy statement, or proposed regional policy statement. It's not so much a definition as a policy. But you constrained small-scale electricity generation facilities. Given that they are also recognised in the NPSREG, can you explain to me why you did that? The discussion in the 42A report says you deliberately excluded small-scale renewable electricity generation facilities which are recognised in the proposed RPS. And my question is, given that the NPSREG says that the benefits are of renewable generation are important at every scale, can you explain to me why you did that?
Probably relate to the fact that we didn't see discrete small-scale renewable facilities or infrastructure as being of regional scale of significance. I mean, collectively, a number of those might be of some scale of significance, but I think that's why we didn't have it there, was we didn't think that constituted something.
The question I would ask you is, do you think that gives effect to the NPSREG?
We'll need to think about that further, but obviously there needs to be consistency with that. So I think my answer is we need to look at this definition in more detail in a considered fashion.
Question for you in relation to policy 32481, which really goes to intent. I don't want, if it's just a drafting issue, then tell me, but I want to understand whether this is deliberate. So concentrate development within existing urban areas. Should that be urban development?
I don't think the word urban is necessary. I think it's implied when we say concentrate development within existing urban areas. I think it's implicit that the development is urban. That would be my view on it.
Now, in terms of your suggested amendment to Objective 3251 related to ONLs and ONFs, obviously a key issue, you suggested broadening it just from a focus on natural character to the quality of ONLs and ONFs. And is that quality singular or qualities plural? And should it be important qualities or is it all qualities?
Yes, so essentially the reasoning for the change was that it was considered that the importance of outstanding natural landscapes and features is more than just relating to natural character. So we broaden that to quality. I guess implicit in the quality of outstanding natural landscapes and features are certain qualities that make up that quality, which will vary, of course, from location to location. It could be reworded as qualities, or I think it could still be in the singular, because there's a particular quality of those landscapes which is made up of different qualities. But
the reason I'm pursuing this is for, partly because it's a fundamental point of a large number of submissions, but also because the reason why for a lot of those submissions the cri de coeur is don't prevent every activity at every location within O&Ls. We need some sense of proportion here. That's my paraphrase of a very large number of submissions. My question is, if we focused on the important qualities of O&Ls and ONFs, and that they are not degraded, so that minor changes to those important qualities and potentially larger changes to perhaps less important qualities, you know, that would be a case-by-case assessment, might be one way to achieve that softening. Well, that's the question I put to you. It's just floating an idea.
Certainly, so, it could be reworded to focus on important qualities, but then I guess the question is, what's an important quality? To answer your question, I think to some extent it's the lower order chapters that flesh out what that quality or qualities are. And I guess I would be hesitant in the strategic direction chapter to go into too finer grain of detail on these matters, but I acknowledge your point at the same time. So.
Now, another vexing issue for a large number of submissions is find it. Oh, yes, 32551. Give preference to farming activity in rural areas. Give preference to what and why? Give preference in what sense? Give preference over what other activities?
That's a good question. What I was intending to do, I guess, was to recognise both historic and current importance and role of farming in the district, and that actually our landscapes, the qualities of our landscapes, have not arisen through accident. They've arisen through the fact that large land holdings, typically farms, have created that sense of scale in large land holdings. And some recognition of that is required, because if these large land holdings are not used for some form of economic activity, I don't think we can expect these large land holdings just to be retained as de facto national parks almost. I mean, my point is that some economic use has to be made of that land. An obvious alternative is housing. So one of the ways to try and help to retain that landscape quality is to recognise the importance of farming and also recognise that farming evolves and changes, and we need to have provisions of policy and regulation that's flexible to allow that. So whether that policy is worded as well as it could be, that's a good question, but that was the intent anyway.
As you've described it, it seems to me that it's not a comparative in terms of giving preference. What you're actually trying to do is to enable farming or encourage farming. Something is that a better sense of where you're getting to?
That's fair to say, yes.
Now, going into section 4, chapter 4, I want to ask you about, like, obviously we've had a very large emphasis on urban growth in Queenstown, Frankton, Arrowtown and Wanaka. I want to ask you about the outlying settlements that don't have urban boundaries, matched urban boundaries. This is 4215 of your recommended revised chapter. urban development is contained within existing settlements. You've deleted, recommended deletion of the word immediately adjacent to. When you don't have a light on a map, what is that word, what is that concept of within those settlements mean? Is that within the existing developed area? Is it within the zoned area? What is it?
The focus of this chapter is on urban development within the areas that are subject to the urban growth boundaries. I guess that's the first thing I'd say. But I accept that when read in isolation, some of the provisions, it's not necessarily clear in isolation. In terms of the general concept, in terms of how we intended that, was that, yeah, it was urban development contained within the urban growth boundaries, essentially. So townships is in stage two of district plan review, and that's a whole another body of work that needs to be considered. And the issues and the growth prospects and approaches for those townships needs to be considered then. So I guess that would be my main answer to your question.
But in terms of giving those specific chapters some strategic direction, what is the intent in your mind, or has the analysis not gone that far, simply?
The analysis hasn't gone that far, to be honest. But I mean, as read at the moment, I think it would imply that for the townships as well, the development is essentially contained. But certainly more analysis is required in stage two to actually look at those townships and the issues. So
in the interim, are you suggesting that there really is no policy about how to deal with growth in those other settlements? And I'm thinking particularly of places such as Glenorchy, Hawea, Luggett and Glenorchy, Luggett and Hawea particularly have reasonably significant growth.
There's of course the operative district plan and its existing township zones and provisions which remain.
But I was meaning at a strategic level.
Right. Again, I think it's in stage two and the townships themselves, and the council will need to consult with the community, get the community's views on growth in those areas, which I think is very important. But I guess to try and sum up my answer is that further work is required. In the interim, I think these objectives and policies do provide some direction. 4215, if you read that in isolation, that does provide some direction, I think, too, for the townships. Although, as I say, the main focus of this chapter was around urban areas where urban growth boundaries apply. So.
Could you clarify, there's just the intent is that when it says existing settlements, by settlements it means settlements with an urban growth boundary around them.
I think that was the intent. I would say it's not clear from the wording. It's the objective itself doesn't actually refer to urban growth boundaries. So, but yeah, the intent of this chapter and the objectives and policies was for it to be related to the urban areas where urban growth boundaries are applied.
Because it was this way that...
I'm just wondering whether that policy is confusing. The intention is it only applies to the four towns, if you like, three towns, rather than all urban settlements. And perhaps it should be phrased that way because...
But it's more than that, because the Queenstown urban boundary has disparate nodes.
Yes, but this is recognised as being the Queenstown boundary. I mean, I read that the first time as applying to all the settlements, even including Makarora, because that's certainly the implication you take from it. But if that's not the implication, it should be explained. explicitly in there.
As I say, I think the intent for this chapter was for it to relate to the urban areas with urban growth boundaries.
For the whole chapter, or that policy just...
For the whole chapter. For the whole chapter.
So therefore, should that be specified in the code?
Yeah, I think to some extent, I mean, this is, I guess, one of the challenges of having the stage district plan review as well, is that... Yeah, we haven't done the work on the townships, and I guess there is the opportunity to revisit some of these provisions once that work's been done. I think it's potentially dangerous to presume things now, but I accept your points.
So summarising that, is the end result, once that policy is clarified, that intentionally there is no strategic guidance at this point for urban development in around the outlying settlements, as like Macklemore, Glenorchy, Hawea?
At this point in time, this chapter's focused on the major urban settlements, but I think it's something we can consider further. And as I say, the intent was always to review the townships in stage two, which would, by necessity, involve some circling back into some of the other chapters that have been occurring in stage one. So,
one last question, and I think that this goes to the function of the urban growth boundary. Objective 4.2.2, the urban growth boundary is a distinct and defendable urban edge, and separately that 4.2.3.7, the edges managed to provide a sensitive transition to rural areas. And they seem, at least on first blush, to be mutually exclusive. You can't have both a distinct urban edge and a smooth transition.
I think you can, because you can transition zoning. So within the immediate boundaries, if you have a, for example, rural residential zoning, that is a form of transition from, say, the low-density zoning. But I think that is still distinctive from what lies on the other side of the boundary, which often, but not always, will be larger lots, more typical rural land use. Of course, there might be some rural residential just outside the boundary as well.
Do you think it might be helpful then to make it clear that what you envisage is a sensitive transition occurring within the urban growth boundary?
Yes.
I think that was Mr. Bird's evidence that that was the only option, not an option.
Yes, that's right. If you've got the boundary, then what's outside the urban growth boundary should be rural, then it doesn't really make sense that you might have some rural residential on the rural side of the boundary. So, yes, I agree with Mr. Bird that is the only option, is to have that transition within.
Can I ask a question that then flows from that, which is that would suggest that you go to a less densely at